Did you think you were God, Brandon?
You don't love me. I'm just something you caught. You think I'm some kind of animal you've trapped.
That's right, you are.
Did you ever try to keep warm on a C-54 at 15,000 feet, 20 degrees below zero?
Oh, I do it all the time.
It's not good to find out too much, Charlie.
But we're sort of like twins, don't you see? We have to know.
Oh, we have 12 vacancies. 12 cabins, 12 vacancies.
Not that I mind a slight case of abduction now and then, but I have tickets for the theater this evening. And I get, well, kind of unreasonable about things like that.
Well, it's a cinch. Here, I look up, I look down. I look up, I look down.
You know, I've got a theory that you should do everything before you die.
Today, I am bringing you a very special bonus episode ahead of HitchCon 2023, an international conference that has taken place online and in person at Mercy University, New York, on the 7th and 8th of October. This unique international Hitchcock conference includes talks from a range of incredible speakers on this year's theme, which is Hitchcock Unbound, reimagining the art of the story. And I'll be there too, virtually, presenting a talk entitled Rooting for Rupert, How Hitchcock Complicates Our Responses to the Hero Anti-Hero of 1948 Rope. I was fortunate enough to have the chance to speak with the president of HitchCon to find out more about the origins of the event, what to expect this year, and to get his thoughts on many aspects of Hitchcock. Come and join us at HitchCon. We hope to see you there. Visit hitchcon.org to read the full lineup, including details of all talks and speakers, screenings and post-film discussions. And I've got a special discount code for you to use too to get 25% off your tickets. Simply apply the code TALKHITCH25 at the checkout and get 25% off your purchase. I hope you enjoy this discussion, and I hope to see you at HitchCon 2023.
Welcome back to Talking Hitchcock. Today, I am joined for post-film drinks in my screening room with writer, filmmaker and president of HitchCon, an annual international Alfred Hitchcock conference. That's a mouthful. Thank you for joining me. I am delighted to introduce Joel Guns. Joel, how are you?
You know what should be added to the list? publisher of the Alfred the Hitchcockian Quarterly.
Of course, yeah. This is the thing. There's so many arms to what you do that it is actually hard to keep a track of it. Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. Also the publisher, kind of editor of the fantastic Hitchcock Quarterly. Yeah. Okay, so we're here primarily to talk then about HitchCon 2023, but I also want to give you the opportunity to share with listeners more about what you do with your blog and the Hitchcock Quarterly. But first, can you tell us a little bit about your journey with Hitchcock then, any early experiences or memories that you've got, and how or why he's become such an instrumental part of your work and your life?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think everybody who is a fan or a geek about Hitchcock has an origin story. Every single person has an origin story. And there's a common thread. The stories are pretty common. Mine is in line with all the others. I was around 12 years old, sixth grade, I think. And I'd heard of Alfred Hitchcock, but I didn't really know anything about him. And I asked my stepdad, who is this guy? And he said that Alfred Hitchcock was this director who had this really amazing ability to manipulate audiences with the way that he edited his films. And through just the selection of images, he could provoke all kinds of responses from an audience. So what I learned about him first was not that he was the master of suspense or the master of the macabre or psycho, but really this kind of arcane, description of what I came to learn later was pure cinema. And so that kind of set me on the journey, age 12. And then, you know, I come to find out that he did make movies with lots of, you know, thrills and chills in them. And again, age 12, I was right at that age when, macabre topics are of interest. It's just a Freudian passage that we go through, right? And so I was raised in a pretty, religiously conservative environment. So watching, John Carpenter films or other, horror gory films was not on the, they were not available to me. But Hitchcock was. And so the first film, actually the first thing that I saw was an interview with him that would run on public television about every 6 months. And it was part of a film series on film directors, or TV series. And he elucidated once again all of his filmmaking techniques in this interview. And he would talk about pure cinema and putting ideas in the audience's mind. And then it would be demonstrated with the murder in the shower from Psycho. And then he would talk about, POV editing, and then it would be demonstrated with scenes from Rear Window. So my experience of Hitchcock was utterly ruined by that, because that was the first thing I saw. And, so I saw the highlights of his career out of context. So when I finally, came to see those movies, I already kind of knew what to expect. And so that I never had that kind of first experience, that virginal viewing, But again, it was like all theoretical. My understanding of him was theoretical. And then the first movie that I saw was Rebecca, and which is a wonderful film, that he insisted that it was not even a Hitchcock film, but it had all the fun, spooky elements, Mrs. Danvers and the creepy house and everything. So at that point I was hooked. And then once again, just a couple of years later, his biography came out, Hitch, and actually would have been, that was right around that same time. And I read that, immediately, just devoured it. And so once again, I'm like developing this relationship with him as a filmmaker and him as a person, before I had a lot of exposure to his movies. So, I think I was either going to become a filmmaker or I was going to become a film, air quotes, scholar, and mm-hmm. life turned out more towards the latter. But
yeah, no, it's interesting. We've had the origin stories of run from The Simpsons to all kinds of things, Hitchcock's DNA is in so much popular culture. But it's interesting that from your experiences were first and foremost more from the editing side, looking at the technical elements of Hitchcock, which I really love, because I actually don't hear those kinds of stories very often. It's often, oh, I saw Rear Window or I saw Psycho. But yeah, I guess it's a shame that you were robbed of that.
I was robbed.
You were robbed. But So I read on your blog that you, as you've already said, you'd see most of Hitchcock's work by quite a young age, but that Vertigo had not been one of those films, but you were given that opportunity later on. And I'm curious to know how that felt, because coming to watch what many would probably consider to be the ultimate Hitchcock film after having seen so much of his filmography already, I really love to know, you use this term that I really loved, BV before Vertigo, which, yeah, I definitely think I can apply that to my Hitchcock journey as well. So this is obviously, this film spoke to you as it has to many people in a deep, profound way. And I just wanted to know more about how that experience changed maybe how you read cinema and what that was like to come to that film much later on?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, another part of the whole story is, so I grew up in the 70s and 80s. I graduated from high school in 84. So that's a little bit of temporal, you know, context, right? And so, you know, at that time, you know, you couldn't watch his films weren't as available, obviously, as they are today. And, you know, VHS itself was just still kind of emerging, you know, early on there. So the only way to see his movies was to either wait for them to come on TV or wait for them to come, you know, around to some local art house cinema. And we were very fortunate to live not too far away from the Roseway Theater in Portland, Oregon. And this is back in the 80s. And it was, they specialized in classic film. And it was run by two men who, they were also a couple, and they absolutely just adored that period. So they restored the theater back to its original glory. They wore the red waistcoats. They had an awesome popcorn machine, and they would give little, you know, talks before the movie started with spotlight. And, you know, they really, really got into recreating this classic experience. So they had a suggestion box in the back of the place. And every time I went to the movies, I would drop in a suggestion, you know, Hitchcock films. And every time a movie, you know, every time they responded to that, I would get free tickets. So these guys, they kind of took me under their wing a little bit and said, here's a Hitchcock nerd. We're going to help this guy out. And I got to know him, and I interviewed him for the school paper and stuff. And so that kind of got me started on the journey. So I think it was 1983, about five, I believe, Hitchcock films that had been held back in the vault, had not been re-released in decades, were finally re-released that year. And one of them was Vertigo. And they got first pick at it. And I had read about it. I knew about the film, of course. I couldn't not, but because it had been out of circulation, a lot of the scenes that would have been wrecked for me weren't, because, you know, it was a blank slate for me. So, as it happened, you know, my parents were also, you know, semi-supportive of this interest. So we would go as a family to go see these movies, but for whatever reason, they couldn't go that night. So I went by myself.
And I was going to say, a family outing to see Vertigo.
Interesting. Oh, this is an aside. So the first time I saw Marnie was with my mom on TV.
Oh, wow.
And that the opening shot of the purse that looks so much like a hairy vulva, right? My mom, who's very proper and very prim, the moment she saw that, she gasped and lunged for the remote control. and then we see that it's just a purse, and everything was okay. But yeah, so that was my introduction to Marnie. But anyway, getting back to Vertigo. Yeah. So I saw it alone, and this was at a, you know, I was what, 17 or so, 16, 17. And just at that age, when I fell in love with Madeline, like I'm right there in the movie, falling in love with her. And, you know, and so when she seems to, you know, perish, you know, halfway through the film, spoiler alert, you know, I'm devastated. And, you know, so I'm with Scotty during that period of mourning and his dark night of the soul. And then as he starts recreating her, you know, I'm right there, you know, and not sure if what's going on. Is this a ghost story? What is it? You know, and I absolutely was experiencing all of that. And then at the end of it, when, spoiler alert again, she dies at the end, I was just gobsmacked by that, just devastated. And I'm sitting there in the theater, just like, you know, staring at the screen, not sure what the hell just happened. And, you know, coping, and people are walking out of the theater, just kind of looking at me like, is this guy okay? I don't think I ever really recovered from that, in a way, you know, or at least every time I see the film, I kind of am put back in that space.
Has your identification shifted over time from Scotty towards Judy at all, or?
Well, that's where, yeah. So that's a first viewing experience, and you can only have a first viewing experience once, right? And so then once you know what happens, then when you go back for the second viewing, it's a completely different experience. And as we know, you know, Hitchcock's films are all meant to be seen twice. you can't see them only once; you have to see them twice. And so, you know, going back, then I'm able to identify more with Judy. And then as years go by and I kind of, you know, grow up a little bit and I understand, you know, empathize just what it's like to be a woman in a man's world and blah, blah, blah. You know, then all these layers of empathy, you know, I can move them around and identify not only with Judy, but with Midge and Madeline and poor Mrs. Elster, who we never meet really. See about four frames of her and Carlotta as well. You know, there are a lot of very, very sad, bereaved women in this film. And they're all sort of, you could say, refracted or reflected, you know, aspects of each other, of one sort of archetypal woman, maybe Carlotta. And and so, you know, getting to know this sort of multifaceted woman figure, is, you know, that's been part of the fun, as well as then continuing to empathize with Scotty and, you know, his, or it's sort of a conditional empathizing. Cause yes, we absolutely should empathize with him fully. He was dealt a raw hand. At the same time, then we can also step back and say, you know, who's the real villain in this picture? And he certainly has some villainous qualities.
So we're going to discuss the many Hitchcock projects that you are involved in. But in keeping with this year's theme for Hitchcock, here are a few words from the man himself on the art of storytelling.
Would you be good enough to explain some of the basic methods in the cinematic approach to storytelling?
Well, you have two kinds of what we might call montage. I think we call it cutting. It isn't exactly that. Cutting implies severing something. It really should be called assembly. Mosaic is assembling something to create a whole. Montage means the assembly of pieces of film which moved in rapid succession before the eye create an idea.
So, Joel, there are, as I've already alluded to, there's a lot of different arms to what you do. So I'm going to try and take it one by one, but feel free to correct me as we go along. I guess, first of all, we've sort of touched on it, but where did this all begin in terms of your writing and your work on Hitchcock? Then how did you get started? Were there some, you've mentioned the experience at the cinema, but were there any key figures who were very influential in you starting this journey?
So I think, you know, so flash forward to maybe even to step back a little bit more context. You can cut this out if you don't think it's relevant, but so the conservative family that I was raised in was Jehovah's Witness. And so there are a lot of do's and don'ts in that life. And one of them is you're not allowed to go to university, go to college. You can go to a trade school or something like that, but anybody who goes to university is putting their spirituality at risk, because, you know, they're going to study things like evolution and dancing, you know. So I did great in school. I should have gone to college and I just didn't. And I decided after high school that, okay, I can't do that. I'm going to hack my education. And so I kind of built a formal program around myself, a curriculum of studying history and literature and film in a serious way. And so while I was doing that, you know, I'm in my 20s at this point, and the internet 1.0 was now a thing, and I discovered these what are they called them? Google had these I think they're called Google Groups, and they're just discussion rooms that had a theme, and I found one that was Hitchcock theme, and it was run, I think it was run by Ken Mogg, author of the Alfred Hitchcock Story. And Stephen DeRosa, my dear friend, Stephen, he was there, author of Writing with Hitchcock. And so it was all these, you know, very, very sharp, high level thinkers and film scholars discussing his films and really, you know, in a very intelligent way. And because it was an internet chat room, anybody could jump in and join the conversation. And I had and continue to have, deal with, you know, I was dealing with a lot of low self-esteem because I hadn't gone to school, and I was around these people who were PhDs and, you know, very, very, educated, formally educated people. But in these chat rooms, I learned that I too have something to say. And I could say something and it would be listened to, and nobody really cared what my background is. It was just the quality of the thinking was really what mattered. Huge, changed so much. And, you know, so, you know, I fell among these film philosophers, and one thing led to another. So again, at the same time, I had an acquaintance who had started an online e-zine. Remember when e-zines were a thing? This is like when blogging was still like in its infancy, you know? And I was writing for free, but he said, "Hey, you want to write some stuff for my e-zine called The Anvil?" And yeah, sure. So I just started writing essays about Hitchcock and other things for them. And that's how it started. And I got to meet another writer who was in advertising as a copywriter, and he, you know, provided feedback and, you know, editorial, you know, help with my writing. So the writing really grew, you know, the quality grew quite a bit, you know, with his help. And so that e-zine kind of went the course of nature, and, you know, eventually kind of he stopped doing it, but I had this, you know, these pieces that I'd written. And so I used those, I just copied and pasted them into a Blogger account, and backdated them a little bit, so that I sort of jump-started this blog with a bunch of content. And, you know, and then from there, just kept on watching and writing. And, cause that's where the money is, you know, in blogging. So, you know, I made pennies. Actually, no, I mean, I don't think I made any money. And of course, it cost quite a bit, you know, at the end of the day, for all of this buying books and things. But no, that's how it got started, just blogging. And so my whole entry into this, you know, Hitchcock experience and all these different things that are going on now were absolutely just hacked and ad hoc and just improvised. And I didn't worry about what I couldn't do or what I didn't have. I just saw what I could do and did that. And one thing led to another. You know?
Yeah, I like what you said there when you talked about finding that community, first of all, and then acknowledging from quite an early stage that despite having a different kind of background, that you yourself did have something important to share and something to say, because stepping into the world of Hitchcockian scholarship can be quite an intimidating, daunting landscape when you do look at the credentials of people. So I think what's so fantastic about what you've spoken to is that you said it beautifully, it's the quality of thinking.
Yeah, and it was interesting, you know, because it's a variety of people. And some of them were very, very open and nurturing, you could say. Others weren't. And, you know, when I came clean and confessed that I really like Quentin Tarantino's films as well, some of these guys came down on me like a hammer, because he's not well loved in the film scholarly community, which I think is stupid and ridiculous and classist and a bunch of other ists. But, you know, and so from then on, some of these people thought less of me. And then I had to deal with that, which was actually good, you know, learning to sort of hold my own position in the face of people who would want to diminish me. Mm-hmm. And that was a lesson that I had to learn, you know, so it's all good, man.
So you've also got a blog called The Alfred Hitchcock Geek, and that contains really an absolute treasure trove of content for Hitchcockians to devour. How did that evolve then? And was that just something that naturally expanded from what you've spoken to already?
Yeah. So that was the blogger account that I started, and initially, or Blogspot is what it's called now, I think mostly. Or maybe it's the other way around. Anyway. And so at some point, you know, I was kind of thinking about how to sort of build an identity around this. And that's when I alighted on the name Alfred Hitchcock Geek. And the tagline that I had for years, and I still use it, was, you know, inspired by Joseph Campbell's dictum to follow your bliss, because that's really what I was doing. And that's what I'm really advocating for here. And so my tagline for the blog was follow your geek. Because whatever it is that you're geeking out on is probably your bliss, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, we need t-shirts. Follow your geek.
Yeah. yeah. So that became the blog, and then it became a thing, and so then right around that same time, social media was coming into its own, and so I started the Alfred Hitchcock Geek Facebook group, and that exploded. And it was through that the blog started getting more and more of a readership. And then out of that, you know, just more relationships with other film scholars, filmmakers, just film fans and nerds, you know, we all sort of coalesced around that. And, you know, so now a community was starting to be formed. And that was, you know, that was interesting and exciting, and also work. And I learned what I want to do around all of this work, and also what I don't want to do, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, requires a lot of babysitting, and I don't like to do that.
So in addition to the blog, then, you also publish, as we've said, the Hitchcock Quarterly, which is this online publication that offers people a chance to get some new perspectives on Hitchcock. Yeah. And there's been some incredible entries there, fascinating editorials from a friend of the podcast, Christine Madrid French, where she has written about the mystical Hitchcock, and then also lots of video content in there, as well as a real mixture and audio content. So tell us more about what the aim is of the Hitchcock Quarterly, who is involved, who can become involved, and what your plans are with it for the future.
Yeah, so the Hitchcock Geek blog, kind of, you know, I haven't contributed much to it lately. And at a certain point, I realized that I always wanted to be a filmmaker. I was supposed to be a filmmaker if it hadn't been for my stupid religious upbringing. And because anybody who goes to Hollywood is just like going straight into the, you know, the anus of the devil, right? So, you know, that just wasn't an option. Coincident with that was an increasing frustration with using the written word to describe cinematic experiences. And obviously there's some wonderful scholarly writing out there that's been so inspiring, but it's also extremely limited because it's a text-based approach to understanding an immersive visual auditory, you know, experience. So I realize that the only way to really appropriately respond to a movie is to make another movie. And, you know, like one of my heroes, George Steiner, you know, the philosopher, says that, you know, the only response to art is to make more art. And writing is an art for sure. And some of these Hitchcock scholars are real artists, but there's also, you know, it leaves something to be desired if that's all you do is read about movies. So I started making film essays and about his work, and kind of approaching them from more of an artful approach and less of a, you know, pedagogical approach. And that's been a whole journey of its own. What the process also did was reaffirm for me the power and the importance and the value of the written word in discussing film. And so all of this was happening at the same time that HitchCon was coming along. And so we were gathering all these speakers together to, you know, talk about his films at this conference. And they'd put all this work into it, and, you know, and then nothing was going to happen after that. And so that's when I started reaching out to speakers saying, hey, do you want to turn that talk, you know, into an essay for the quarterly? And, you know, almost every one of them has said, yes, please. They'd already written it. Now it just had to be sort of zhuzhed up and, you know, prepped for the magazine. So, that's, so it's kind of born from HitchCon. It was also born from a rejection of the written word, and then a consequent return to it. You know, and the plan for the quarterly is to make it more of an immersive experience. So right now it's a pretty straightforward, you know, online magazine experience, but there are a lot of digital tools out there that, can incorporate animation and video and really cool, interesting ways. And so that's, you know, that's the next direction to take it in.
Great.
As well as a print edition that's coming too.
I was going to ask, yeah, print edition would be fantastic. But then I guess you're limited with the less textual element of it. But yeah, I love that you're keeping those talks alive, because as you say, there's so many fantastic speakers and so much work that goes into it, so much thinking, that to keep those alive through the Hitchcock Quarterly is just fantastic. Moving on then to talk about HitchCon. So if I'm right, this is now its third year. What an undertaking this must be to bring this together as someone who manages events in other parts of my creative world. I can empathize with just the planning and the preparation, the scheduling. Where was this idea born out of then, and how did you establish it, and how have you seen it grow over these 3 years? What's that been like, those 3 years from where it started and where it is now?
Yeah, so this one came in completely out of the blue. Had no idea that it was going to happen. But another Hitchcock author named Mark Strauss, he was planning a conference. And but he wanted some help with it. So he just emailed me out of the blue. I barely knew the guy. He said, hey, how would you like to co-host this conference with me? And he was turning his garage into a miniature conference center up in Cape Cod. And so I said, sure. Okay. Yeah, let's do this. And so that's, and I love how the collaboration happened, because he had already picked a theme, and it was something about lessons and love in Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. And so this is COVID. My girlfriend and I had just moved from Portland, Oregon, which is a center of a lot of unrest, which had become a center of unrest here in America, to Missoula, Montana, which was not, you know, it was very, very Western ranch country, cattle country. And, you know, I've seen these reports on the news about, you know, violence and divisiveness and, you know, things were just really breaking apart. And I wanted to be somehow make a contribution to helping, you know, helping a healing. And, you know, at that same time that I started, you know, really discovering a magic practice and, you know, practicing some magical arts. So just putting the intentions out there about what to do about this. And my intention was, how can I bring more love into the world? the next day or whatever, you know, I get this email from Mark Strauss saying, hey, I want to start a conference about Alfred Hitchcock and his lessons in love. So, you know, that's kind of how these things work, right? These things manifest. And so I had to say yes. Like, I was obligated to say yes to the offer because of all these, this context. And so, so I wrote back and said, yes, if we can change the title to "What's It All About, Alfie?" Alfred Hitchcock's Lessons in Love. I'm proud of that. It's, you know, when we were supposed to do the conference, you know, at his place in Cape Cod, but with COVID and everything, we decided to not do that and just do it as an online thing. And so that's how it started out, as a Zoom event. So.
Wow. I know Mark through emails and things. So I had no idea that he was sort of so connected to the foundations of Hitchcock. That's incredible. So, yeah. So you've got a tremendous board of advisors supporting you, some who've been on the podcast already, the wonderful Liz Carlin and incredible Beth Bullock, and others as well, of course. But I hope at some point to have them all on the podcast to cover a film. That's the goal. So we're working through them. What is the role then of the board, and how did those people come together?
Yeah. So after Hitchcon 21, Mark and I decided, you know, that we love doing this, but we didn't necessarily need to do our Hitchcock geekery together. So we're still friends, but we decided to just go our separate ways. And so after that, then I realized, you know, I can't do this by myself. And so I just reached out. I just made an A-list of people that I had met through the conference that I wanted to have on advisory board. And everybody who I invited said yes. One person did have to drop out just because of scheduling conflicts. So just to name them, because each one of these people is really bringing something special to the board. Mm-hmm. You know, so Lizzie Carlin she's a playwright, you know, and she's got an awesome story. Her origin story is
utterly fantastic. Unique. Yeah.
and she had been a co-host actually on the Alfred Hitchcock Geek Facebook page with me for years, and she'd written for the blog, and that's how she came into it. And then Beth Bullock is you know, she's kind of represents definitely the kind of the new wave, the next wave of film scholarship. She's a film studies teacher in Chicago. Sid Gottlieb is he's the godfather of Hitchcock studies, publisher, editor of the Hitchcock Annual. There's a whole shelf full of books that he's either written or edited. And so he's really done a lot to shape and also provide all of us with resources to understand his films. He was the one who collected together Hitchcock's greatest interviews and published them all together in one book. One of the most important resources, you know, out there, right? So Sid, Walter Robicek is another one who, he's a kind of a triple threat because he's a Hitchcock scholar, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and G.K. Chesterton. Oh, and T.S. Eliot as well. And so just a super smart guy, university, you know, professor at Pace University. And he's, you know, he's another, you know, kind of a senior guy. He's just providing a lot of guidance. He's organized a conference or two himself. And so he, you know, is able to provide a lot of that, you know, kind of organizational wisdom and experience. Pat McFadden is another great guy. He's kind of come into the world, you know, in the same way that I have, not as an academic, but as a filmmaker and just a lover of Alfred Hitchcock's films. And, he's got a deep, deep knowledge. He's one of these guys, you'll watch a movie and he can tell you, you know, on a dime, the name of every actor in every scene and every film that you could possibly see. He's got a mind like a steel trap. So, you know, he's fantastic. Oh, and then finally, I think Steven DeRosa, I think he's the last member of the board. I hope I haven't forgot anyone, but author of Writing with Hitchcock, which was one of the first books, along with Walter Robichek's books, that have sort of helped us release our death grip on auteur theory, and start acknowledging that Hitchcock's writers were extremely important to the creative process. And so Writing with Hitchcock is about Hitch's relationship with John Michael Hayes, who wrote, you know, four of his greatest hits in the 50s. So so he's super important. And like this year, now that Hitchcock is in its third year, it's at Mercy University, which is where Stephen teaches. And he's just doing a phenomenal job helping kind of liaison between the event and the school to make it happen and pull all the logistics together. He's doing a heroic job. You know, it's really cool. Like Sid, you know, is been my hero. You know, I had all these books, and then I met him at the conference, and then I invited him to be on the board, and he said yes. So it's just, and he's a really sweet gentleman. You know, he's modeling how to be an appropriate scholar, how to be opinionated and strong-minded, and you know, hold your position, and at the same time be open to new things and responsive. He's a model of that, and also just of a, kind of an old school diplomacy that I think a lot of us kids can learn from. So
great. No, it's fantastic to hear more about the people around HitchCon that are supporting it. And it sounds like there's a multitude of different strengths at play there. And it's just going to be great to see how that board continues, how it continues to diversify, because obviously, you know, representation is incredibly important. So yeah, no, it's a fantastic team that you've got. So yeah, you've touched on the theme already. So I wanted to ask a little bit about how you set these themes, who chooses them, and what are your thoughts around this year's theme, which is about the art of storytelling?
Yeah, so the project is my baby, for sure. And so I've got a secret list of themes, you know, now through the end of time, because we just can't stop talking about this guy and his films.
And I've got a list of themes too. Yeah.
Oh, great. I'd love to see it. Send it my way.
We should do a comparison.
Yeah, absolutely.
The top absolutely. Tropes of themes. Yeah.
The top tropes, you know, we could crowdsource next year's theme. Why not? So, the idea is to keep them topical if possible. So again, Lessons in Love, you know, is just like at a very dark and weird time in history. And then the next year was followed up on that. So Alfred Hitchcock in a time of crisis, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was the same thing, like the world is going to hell, man. And so what can his films teach us about how to approach this? And of course, he was a master at understanding and depicting and sort of putting the audience through an experience of trauma. And, you know, we're going through traumatic times. And so there's a lot of value just in watching his films and then having those all important icebox conversations after the movie about it. So that was kind of the driving force behind that. This year, lightened the tone a little bit. Storytelling Reimagined is the theme this year. And or Reimagining the Art of the Story, actually, is the official title. And media is going through a lot of changes right now. And we're, you know, we as always, right? And so cinema has moved from, his films were meant to be seen in a crowded theater, you know, away from home, Excellent word. Yeah. Collective experience. And now, you can stream his movies on your iPhone if you want, all by your little lonesome. And, and at the same time, other things are changing. So, how are there lessons in evolving storytelling art that we can derive from his films? And it's something that he thought about quite a bit, you know, as he compared cinema to live theater, or compared cinema to the novels and stories that he was pulling from. And you have to tell stories, obviously, in a different way on screen than you would in the theater or in a book. And there are opportunities, but there are also limitations. And so, how can we, as storytellers, as creative people, or just, thinking people, with the new tools that we have, digital tools, how can we, is there anything that we can learn from his films to sort of advance art as it's going forward now? And I think the answer is, obviously yes. So, and it, so we got these, that was the germ. That was the idea. And I think it's absolutely fascinating that several of the talks actually are taking a very, very backward look at storytelling techniques that Hitchcock employed in his work. So it's like, Marshall McLuhan said that every time, we get a new technology, we end up using it backwards, right? We look backward for influence to figure out how to use a new technology going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got Thomas Leach, who will be talking about almost prehistoric storytelling techniques, oral storytelling techniques that predate like Greek tragedy, to show how Hitchcock was drawing on those to build a scene.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, his technique was to start with something very, very small and granular, like a key, right? Mm-hmm. A thing, just a key. And how do we build a story around a key? And that's a very ancient technique. And then Richard Allen, he'll be talking about Catholic passion plays, medieval storytelling, and how Hitchcock was drawing on that, for example, for I Confess, but other films.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and Beth Bullock will be talking about fairy tales.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and very excited for that. Those. Yeah.
So it's all all these pre-modern influences.
Wow.
And so I love that. I think it's going to be just really fascinating. I think people who are, in the storytelling field, either as a hobby or profession, are going to get some real inspiration to put more verve and just more stuffing into their work,
So as someone who's attended, I can say every HitchCon,
yay.
Yay. What I really appreciated about it I must say that when I was talking to friends about HitchCon, they mistakenly thought it was some kind of convention where people all dress up as their favorite Hitchcock characters.
That's the goal.
Maybe one of the events in the evening we could arrange that, I'm sure. But yeah, one of the things that I loved straight away is that this is not a purely dry academic conference. This feels to me like more of an exchange of ideas, if you like. So I wanted to ask about, in terms of, and a lot of that is, that is down to the speakers and the diversity of those speakers, the different, art forms they come from, their backgrounds, their perspectives, how who they are informs their perspective. So I wanted to ask, when it comes to the lineup of HitchCon, how important is diversity to you, and how do you go about, ensuring that happens?
Yeah, it's extremely important. And again, I view myself as an outsider in this field, and because you've had these scholars who are they're the usual suspects who go to these Hitchcock, you know, conferences, and love them, and they're great, they're wonderful people, but it's a little bit of an echo chamber when when it's all film studies majors getting together to talk about film, people who've never actually made a film. And so, you know, so it's like, it's job one to get, you know, a diversity of voices in there, especially with cinema, because it is so, itself is a democratic, medium, you know? So the first thing, is I'm constantly looking for filmmakers, and they're actually hard to find because they don't want to talk, they want to make. You know, so you think about it, it's like, yeah, no duh. But, you know, Norman Buckley, has been, you know, a great supporter of it. And he's, of course, the producer of Steel Magnolias and, Pretty Little Liars, and, just a ton of TV work that's, like, you know, really highly regarded. So, and he's a Hitchcock scholar. So he's been great. But anyway, so the idea is to definitely bring in filmmakers and then get a dialogue going between the film studies majors and the filmmakers. And then along the way, also just to get a, you know, diversity of voices. So, yes, you know, men and women, or black and white, or, you know, queer voices, and an international, you know, perspective as well, super important. Last year we had film scholars from Poland who were just like, really kind of broke everybody's brain, because looking at Hitchcock through the eyes of a Polish film nerd is another experience entirely. So, the idea that the vision is to have a jazz jam session. And it's 1945, you know, and you've got Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. But then you have some guy on drums that you never heard of and you never will. And then you have, you know, some student who he's 16 years old and he just dropped in, and, you know, and he's learning his craft, and, you know, he's dropped into this. And then you have some bozo who's drunk off his ass. He gets to take his solo as well. And, you know, you have has-beens, and you're going to have never-wases, and then you're going to have the greats all together. And it's that coming together of all these different levels and qualities and experiences. And I don't know if you've been to a jazz jam, but I played drums for years. I finally had to get out of it because my hearing is shot. But, there, you know, there's always some guy who shows up and he's got one hot lick. And he can't do anything else. But when it's time for him to play that hot lick, he's just the star of the show, right? I want that guy. I want him at the conference. And he'll be there once, but that'll be great, you know? So that's the vision. And we're kind of getting there. There's a risk that it'll go off the rails. And last year it kind of did a little bit. And but that's okay. You know, that's what keeps it real. You know, that's also where the magic is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And in your lineup, you've got academics, filmmakers, playwrights, up and coming students, podcasters. Over the last few years then, Joel, what has it been like for you to hear from these people who come from all these corners of the world, all these backgrounds, and how has that shaped your relationship with Hitchcock's work?
Yeah, I think, for one thing, that's when I get to be the spectator and I can step away, you know, from the work of putting it together and just like take it in. And it's definitely been, a learning process as well. So for example, like the part of the program that went a little bit off the rails was, we decided to tear the Band-Aid off of this, you know, Hitchcock in the era of Me Too. And, which is it's a difficult topic to address. The conversation that would defend Hitchcock has been dominated by, white men, and those who would take a position that would be more critical of his relationship with women have been, women who haven't been given a voice. So managing that from a, you know, just as a event organizer, you know, had, you know, some, it was challenging.
Mm-hmm.
I handed it off to Beth, you know, Beth Bullock, and she just did a fantastic job putting it together. And she, you know, she had carte blanche to put it together however she wanted, and which is necessary.
Yeah.
And then the conversation that took place during that, because we had, you know, several talks, and then we had a panel discussion among them, it was both painful and real and raw and also educational. And I think a lot of, let's be frank about it. I think a lot of dudes, a lot of guys, men, me included, came out of there with a more, you know, attenuated understanding. I think there are a lot of misconceptions, and I want to, you know, stand up and still defend him. There's a lot of chatter. The internet, you know, amplifies a lot of things that frankly are not true, but at the same time, there's nothing there, you know, so we need to think about this and the power dynamics at play. And it was really gratifying to see, you know, some audience members come away and say, yeah, I learned something. You know, I think I'm going to look at things a little bit differently now. So that was the goal, you know, just to move the needle, just to open minds a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we got there.
Yeah, it's all about having the conversation, isn't it? And being able to shine that perspective and have that, you know, I guess, you know, you've got to have a lot of sensitivity around what you're doing, and you know, those kinds of conversations can be triggering for audience members. And I think, you know, as long as everybody's comfortable in that environment and there is that support, and it just goes to show the relevancy in terms of what these conversations, you know, we can start to think we're having conversations about filmmaking, but then just how it intersects with the way we live our lives, the way we view the world, the way, you know, we view other people. Yeah. It just spreads, doesn't it? So.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And Hitchcock's films really are at the center of that. Like they're sort of, because his films are about, how do we look at women? How do we look at men? How do we look at the, you know, the male gaze? And what does that even mean? You know, like he's kind of like the nexus of that kind of a conversation, or he can be anyway. And that's what makes his films so relevant. Mm-hmm. Decades after they were made.
I think the thing with Hitchcock across himself as a man and as an artist, there's just, there's so many, and he's almost like a man of contradiction and complexity, and it's hard to, ambiguity, and they're the things that I love about Hitchcock, but they're the things that keep the conversation going, but they're also the things that make it a very it's a very tenuous place to exist in. It's almost like this in-between mm-hmm. world where we can never fully get to one end of the spectrum or the other. We're in this sort of no man's land, it feels, but that's what generates that conversation. And I feel like there's a lot of things with Hitchcock that we'll never get to the bottom of, but we'll keep having the conversations, and those conversations will help facilitate learning, not just about his art, but about life.
Yeah, well put. Yeah. I love that word. It's a tenuous place. Everything, you know, everything in his films is so, peace is provisional, war is provisional, love and hatred, they're all provisional, contingent, tenuous, conditions that, one flick of the finger or gust of wind can change everything. That's like kind of the lesson in his films, really, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that there, I see his films as being almost meditations on the fragility of life, you know. Mm-hmm. Like you say, it's that tenuous stage. I often talk on the podcast about one of the things I love most about Hitchcock is the endings and the ambiguity of those endings that seem to suggest, you know, everything's tied up in a neat little bow, but actually, you know, when we take a closer look, there's a lot of uncertainty and ambivalence about those endings, and I that's something that I really appreciate, not just in Hitchcock but in cinema as a whole.
Yeah, we just had our movie night last night, and we showed Strangers on a Train, and that has one of those ambiguous endings. And I hadn't made the connection before, but at the end of the film, Farley Granger and Ruth Roman are on the train, and a priest, a Catholic, or I think it's a Protestant priest on the train, introduces himself. "Aren't you Guy Haines?" Just like the beginning of the movie. And they say no, and they go away. And so it's at that little sour note, you know, that Hitch likes to end with. But anyway, we see a priest, and his very next film was I Confess. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of a wonderful linkage.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, that's one of the things I love about his films, is that I'm a big fan of the one big film theory, that he didn't make 53 or 54 discrete films, but he just made one long 60 hour movie over the course of his life. I like that idea.
That could maybe be part of next year's program, like a 60 hour epic Hitchcock marathon.
Oh, that would be awesome. Just back to back. Like a Clockwork Orange, you know, just like.
So I think this is the first time that, correct me if I'm wrong, Joel, but that the event is hybrid. So being held in person and online, which is just incredible from an accessibility point of view. One of the things I've always loved about Hitchcock is its accessibility. But how are you feeling about making that leap to be in a hybrid event?
It's fucking terrifying. It is like panic attacks on a daily basis. Not gonna lie, it is so stressful. And because basically what you're doing is you're putting on two shows at once, and it's not even just like putting on two shows at once, because you have to be thinking about your audience, your remote audience and your local audience. You've also got remote speakers and local speakers, and just technologically they all have to be able to talk to each other. So a remote audience member has to be able to raise their hand and ask a question that the on-site speaker can hear and respond to. So not only are you putting on two shows at once, but then you've got another layer of just technological complexity required to manage all of that and make sure that the cameras are on when they're supposed to be on, and make sure they're turned off when they're supposed to be turned off, and blah, 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 blah. I mean, it just goes on and on. So the good news is I've got a wonderful team of producers on hand who will be managing that. We've also got a couple of absolutely whip smart students from Mercy University who will be helping out as well. The downside is that that costs money. And this is just a little humble little conference. That it's never been a moneymaker, and I don't expect it ever to. So we got to get the butts in seats, you know, to make sure that this all happens. That's part of the stress, but also one thing can go wrong. You know, we have to commit the perfect conference here. And if one dongle craps out on you in the middle of the event, you're hosed. So, you know, it's a lot of planning, you know, and making sure that all the right people are talking to each other and all the right questions are being asked. So, but at the end of the day, like you said, I mean, the whole idea is inclusive. Like those are the marching orders. It's written into the mission statement that this has to be inclusive on stage. It has to be inclusive in the audience. And so the vision would be to even, you know, blow that out even further. And there are a lot of ways to talk about Hitchcock's films that have nothing to do with words. Interpretive dance, or, I would love to, you know, get an orchestra, and part of the evening would be just a roundup of orchestral music from his films. An art show. There's all kinds of fan art out there that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. To your question earlier, why not a costume contest? Hell yeah. Let's do that. So, you know, because that's making a statement too. And that says something. So, you know, the longer range goal would be to take more inspiration from Burning Man, you know, and less inspiration from, you know, the annual gathering of oncology surgeons, academic conference.
Wonderful. So as well as these speaker presentations, it's important to tell listeners that you've also got screenings as part of the event, post-film discussions. Can you tell us anything about what you've got planned for those sort of additional events?
Yeah, so on Saturday night, we'll be screening Shadow of a Doubt, because it's the 80th anniversary of that film. And as a lead up to this, because we do our Wednesday night events, and the Wednesday prior to that, we'll be screening I Confess. And that's because there'll be several talks we'll be discussing I Confess. So people should, you know, jump aboard for that too. So we do these movie screenings, and then what has happened every year is afterwards we just have our conversation. We just call it the icebox conversation. And of course, as you know, that's derived from after the movie is over, then the couple goes back, they send the babysitter home, and they're eating leftovers from the icebox. And that's when they, you know, they have their analysis of the film, the plot holes that Hitchcock threw at them, or the meaning of it. I've broken up with two girlfriends after watching Rear Window, because it's a movie about a relationship that's on the, you know, it's kind of a little bit curdled. And so it's all good. With Christy, we've been together 8 years now, and she's seen Rear Window a couple of times, and we're still together. So that's how I know that
she's safe.
She's a keeper. Yeah. So we do these iSpot conversations after the movie, and they've tended to go late into the night. So I'm hoping that this will happen as well.
And are those available for guests virtually as well as in person?
Yep. Yeah. They'll be able to talk. And so my role will be to kind of manage both of these conversations. So I might concentrate more on the digital conversation, because there'll be other, like, board members can kind of help sort of keep things managed for the in-person conversation, which will actually be much more spontaneous, and there's not a lot of management.
Mm-hmm.
Needed, so.
Mm-hmm. So looking ahead to the future then, do you plan to continue with HitchCon, expand it, develop it? What's the status of it at the moment?
The idea is to keep doing it, absolutely. And, you know, this will be a learning experience, learning how to do a hybrid conference. And so once I will have learned it, next, it's, you know, it's like murder. The more you do it, the easier it gets, right? So next year will be much, you know, I'm hoping that it'll be much easier to do. Mercy University has been absolutely great to work with. They have just come through in so many ways, and Stephen's been such a big help with that. So we'll, you know, continue to do that as well. Again, the idea is to expand the creativity and expand the ways to have a conference. And so I think that's a big part of it as well. And then, you know, these Wednesday night, it's kind of a salon experience, and we're going to keep doing that. And the plan is to make that grow. You know, right now we're getting a couple of dozen people each Wednesday. And so the idea would be to put a zero or a two on that number and see how those conversations sort of evolve and morph. So
I would love, I feel like I something similar here in the UK, because your salon events are the wee hours of the morning for me, which is so frustrating. But something for the future maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, or we could do something earlier in the day, because we've got a few Brits who would love to join. And we actually have a couple that do, you know, that come in at 2 a.m. or whatever it is.
Wow. For them.
And so they're stalwarts.
They're hardcore. But,
and it, you know, and then, like, speaking of this idea of new media, so the interesting thing about doing these screenings over Zoom is you get a little bit of the audience experience that you might enjoy, you know, going to the movies, but it's completely different because you're in your home and people are usually watching on a device that's deeply intimately connected to them, right? A laptop or an iPad, which is, you know, which is an opposite experience from going out to the movies, which are sort of designed to be an other, you know, out there experience. The screen is 50 feet away. Mm-hmm. The projector is 50 feet behind you. But these people, you know, they're watching on a laptop that they might be working on all day. And so it's an extension, you know, of their fingers. This is an extension of their eyeballs in a very McLuhan-esque kind of way, right? So the way they're engaging with these movies is different. And what we're seeing happen with these events is, and then there's another feature on there, which is the chat feature. So while we're watching the movie, people are text chatting in the Zoom room, and which here's the difference, I think. Cinema, public cinema, has to overcome that distance to create intimacy with the audience. And it does so by means of montage editing and the close-up, and as well as other things, music and things. But those are the two primary techniques that Hitchcock understood really well. So what does that mean when we already have that intimacy built in, and, you know, into the medium itself? So here's what's happening. Because it's a really smart group of individuals who are showing up for these events, the discussion is really stimulating. And it's a combination of people sort of doing the kind of like the director's track, you know, director's commentary on a DVD. Mm-hmm. You're getting a little bit of that. You're also getting a little bit of Mystery Science Theater 3000, where people are sort of, you know, making fun of the silly accents or whatever. And then you're getting just sort of random, you know, expressions of, oh, Grace Kelly is so beautiful. And so it's that, again, it's kind of like that jam session feel. But then what's happening is the film gets objectified in ways that may not happen in a public setting. But the audience is coming together and becoming much more intimate with each other in ways that a public event may not happen. And we get to do something that you could never do at the movies, which is talk during the movie, right? That's the number one rule. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of talking, you can't even do that at home. You know, your spouse will tell you to shut up or whatever. So this is a new media experience. I think it's completely new. And obviously, you know, a lot of other people are doing watch parties, but the way to kind of think that through is really important. And like, you know, as the person who's presenting it, then I want to kind of think through like, okay, so how am I going to moderate the conversation, you know, so that it doesn't go off the rails, or, you know, how are we setting this up? How are we creating the right mood, you know, and tone for everybody as they go into it? Those are super important questions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, Hitchcock's movies are the perfect place to try that out in, because his movies are already all about all those questions. but I think, you know, going forward, like, I think it's a really, if I were, you know, making feature films, I'd be really thinking about how, if I were to make a feature film for a watch party, how would I change the writing, the cinematography? Like, how would I accommodate this particular set of circumstances? So,
oh, fascinating. So we've got so we've got Shadow of a Doubt to look forward to. So What's coming up next for you then? I mean, dare I say it? Yeah, I don't want to put pressure on you. I mean, Hitchcon is more than enough, but beyond Hitchcon then, if you got anything that you're working on at the moment, or is it just a case of keeping all these amazing projects up in the air?
So, yeah, I mean, it's a lot of that. The salon is going to come into its own in the next few weeks and months as well. And we're moving it over to another streaming platform so that all of the content that we have, we've recorded from Hitchcon, as well as, so I've got dozens of videos and film essays and things that I've made about his films. It's all going to be consolidated into one streaming platform. So it'll be kind of a Netflix like experience. And then through that same platform, then we'll also do our salons, and we want to grow that. So we're looking for hosts to host the same thing on other nights.
Hitchflix, I like it. I like the idea of Hitchflix.
yeah, absolutely. Hitchflix. And so they're right now, the videos, you know, they're all produced by me. And Stephen DeRosa has a couple as well, but we'll be opening that up to anybody who is a film essayist to, you know, or documentarian, you know, to put their stuff up there. So the idea is to move beyond Hitchcock as well, but, you know, sort of expand the boundaries of the crazy wall beyond his work and, you know, highlight the work of his collaborators or peers or just other classic film. I think the scope would be limited to films from the classic era, but that's a pretty wide field. So
amazing. What should keep you busy until the end of time? It's time for Rebecca Recommends. Now, usually I would recommend an outside resource, but today all I want to do is direct you to hitchcon.org to find out more about this incredible event and to purchase your tickets. So head on over there and, yeah, we look forward to seeing you there. I'll be speaking there. Yes. Joel's going to be there, you know, Master of Technology and Communications. Head on over to hitchcon.org and check out the lineup and, yeah, make sure you grab your tickets. Yeah, so you can also get 25% off your tickets if you apply the discount code that is TalkHitch25. That's TalkHitch25. Redeem that code and get 25% off. Yeah, we look forward to seeing you at Hitchcon 2023. So thanks so much to my wonderful guest, Joel, for taking the time to be here with me for this discussion and for sharing more about the fantastic work that you do. So, Joel, where can people find you online? And is there anything specific that you'd like to promote that you've got coming up?
Well, I think I'd love to see more and more people at Hitchcon. It's going to be might be a once in a lifetime event with because we've got a lot of OG scholars coming in, convening here. So William Rothman, author of The Murderous Gaze, Murray Pomerantz, author of An Eye for Hitchcock, Sid Gottlieb's going to be there. Tom Leach is another keynote speaker. He's the author of the Alfred Hitchcock Encyclopedia. And Richard Allen, former editor of the Hitchcock Annual. And then another keynote speaker who I can't wait to see her speak, Paula Marantz Cohen. Mm-hmm. And she's the author of The Talking Cure. And she's really put a lot of thought into the art of conversation and how it needs rehabilitating right now. And her book is a key text for me and thinking about how to put together events like Hitchcon or our, you know, Wednesday salons, super important. So she'll be talking about conversation and Hitchcock and how conversations in Hitchcock films can teach us how to talk to each other. Wow. So, pretty interesting stuff anyway. Yeah. So yeah. I'd love to see more people, catch this cause it's going to be a good one. It's our biggest event by far.
Amazing. And where can people find you online?
Hitchcon.org is a great place to go. And then two other places, Alfred Hitchcock Geek on Facebook and Alfred Hitchcock Geek on Instagram. And then on Twitter is great too. And that's just Joel Guns, at Joel Guns.
Amazing. And I'll make sure to link all those as well in the show notes so people have got those to go to. Okay. Well, thank you for joining me today. It is time to leave the bar of my screening room, but don't fret. You can find Talking Hitchcock on Twitter at @Hitch_pod and Instagram at Talking Hitch Pod. So if you like what you hear, consider supporting the podcast and giving us a follow and maybe even leaving us a rating on iTunes. If there's anything you'd like to share, you can reach us on talkinghitchpod@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this conversation or any of the episodes, please tell a friend and help us to spread the word. I've been your host, Rebecca, and you can find me on my work, including my series of essays on Hitchcock's women with Moving Pictures Film Club on Twitter and Instagram at @PendlePumpkin. Thank you so much for being here with me today. I look forward to seeing you back in my screening room soon. But until next time, stay curious and keep talking Hitchcock.